You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, white working class men increasingly feel left behind in the working world, but our guest says there are service sector jobs available in professions often seen as women's work. We'll hear about jobs and gender coming up.
First, it's no secret that there's a big gap in wealth between black and white people in the U.S. A Federal Reserve survey from 2013 showed that the median net wealth ratio of a black to white family was $1 to $13. The gap between white and Latinos was only a little bit smaller.
There are a lot of common explanations out there for this racial wealth gap. You may have heard people talk about varying levels of higher education or two-parent versus single-parent households or savings as reasons for the racial wealth gap, but a new study challenges some of those assumptions.
Laura Sullivan joins us now. She's one of the authors of the study and a senior research associate at Brandeis University's Institute on Assets and Social Policy. Laura, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks so much for having me.
So if it's not the college education, it's not the steady career and being prudent about spending, what is behind this racial wealth gap?
Well, our findings really show that, you know, individual behavior helps individuals individually, but that really cannot help break these disparities at a societal level. So we know from the beginning of our nation, from the start of our history with slavery, that there were huge disparities in terms of the ability to build assets over time. And those disparities continued throughout the 20th century, and policies continue to impact how families build wealth. So from redlining in the 20th century to the GI Bill after World War II, we see that wealth disparities were really created by policy and that individual behaviors are not going to be enough to change those patterns that we see.
So you're really keying in here on passing money, perhaps real estate assets, from one generation to the next?
Well, it's true. When one family already has assets, that wealth helps to build more wealth in the future. So, for example, if your family has assets, they can help you go to college, they can help you put a down payment on a house, and that helps you avoid debt, if it's in terms of college and student debt, student loans, or in terms of a larger down payment, say that can actually reduce your total financing costs. And so earlier generations that had wealth, which typically were white households, are able to boost up following generations. And so these patterns continue over time.
And saving is something that is seen as being more difficult for people with less disposable income. You would think that if you can't save much, you have less wealth. Why isn't that true according to your study?
Well, it's not that saving, you know, doesn't matter. It's just that we find that saving is not the key to changing these disparities that we see. So our data in this particular segment of the paper, we build on work from Duke University, and they find that at every level of the income distribution, white households actually typically spend more than black households. So it's not spending that's really making the difference in terms of the racial wealth gap. It's really access to familial wealth, access to returns on some of these things that we see. So some of our previous work has shown that a college education provides greater returns to white households than households of color, and part of that has to do with continuing discrimination in the labor market.
What about the amount of hours worked? Which group is working more, and how might that impact wealth?
Well, we actually find that even when you're comparing households working full-time, households of color make less money than white households. And if you add gender into that scenario, women of color make much less than men working full-time. And so even households working similar amounts of time, all working full-time, you see these major disparities in terms of wages, and then that makes it harder for folks to save. And we see those same disparities in pensions, and so those retirement savings that help folks build wealth continue to exist because of the disparities in employer-based benefits.
Yeah, talk a little bit about the parallel you're seeing in pensions and retirement funds here. What's running parallel?
Well, I think, you know, the retirement community and retirement research have really identified that there's been long standing disparities in terms of pension access. And so some of the new efforts to get state-based pension programs and more access to IRAs, such as the MyRA program, are new opportunities to get more folks saving. But these, you know, these sort of structural changes are what we need to see. We need to be opening access to programs as opposed to just hoping folks can save on their own.
We're talking with Laura Sullivan. She is a senior research associate at the Institute on Assets and Social Policy at Brandeis University, looking at new research that in a study that debunks some of the things behind the racial wealth gap. Notably, that study, it says, you know, education isn't behind the racial wealth gap, or whether how much you work. It has a lot to do with family inheritance. What does this say then for minorities, for people of color? Do you see this as something that could be quite discouraging?
Well, I think we don't want to send a discouraging message. You know, our report really indicates that for all households, regardless of race and ethnicity, going to college, partnering and having a two-parent household, working full-time, all of those things do lead to better outcomes. But what our findings really suggest is that it's not going to be enough to overcome the disparities that we see. And so that's why we really need to open up access to asset-building opportunities across these different policy areas so that families can save and so that the returns to these achievements are more equalized.
And how much a role, if any, do you think individual choices have on the racial wealth gap?
Well, I think our findings really show that individual choices are not driving the racial wealth gap. It's really structural and policy decisions that we've made as a society that have allowed white households over time to build wealth and then pass that along to following generations. And so we can't really deal with these long-standing policy problems with individual-based solutions. And so we suggest that really to tackle these challenges, we need to be thinking from a more structural and policy level.
What message should policymakers take from your research, from your study?
Well, I think that they need to know how important the racial wealth gap is, that assets and wealth really are a opportunity for households to build long-term security, to weather a rainy day, and to provide opportunities for mobility for their children, but that we need to invest in all families and make sure that all families have access to the resources to go to college and do that without debt, have access to jobs and aren't facing discrimination in the labor market. So we want to make sure that as folks are pursuing all of these achievements in their lives, that our policies are supporting them in doing that.
And Laura, finally, as you move forward in your research, what question do you tackle next in the racial wealth gap? Where do you take it from here?
Well, I think that's a really good question. We do research in a number of areas, but we're hoping to continue to really drive discussions about what are the sources of the racial wealth gap and what are particular policies that can help reduce the racial wealth gap. And so some of our other research has shown that universal policies that don't take into account existing need may actually exacerbate the racial wealth gap. And so we're hoping to help inform policy decisions such that we can promote policies that have a more targeted universalism approach, as we call it, which means really taking into account existing needs as we design programs that help all households.
Thanks so much for your time today, Laura.
Thanks so much for having me.
That was Laura Sullivan, Senior Research Associate at the Institute on Assets and Social Policy at Brandeis University. She joined us to talk about the role that inheritance plays in the racial wealth gap. The last election brought into sharp focus the plight of men who feel they've been left behind in a new global economy.
More than a fifth of American men are unemployed, but there are many service sector jobs that go unfilled. Recent studies show that higher growth occupations are now mostly filled by women, while men seem to avoid a lot of those jobs. Jeanette Dill joins us now. She's a sociologist at the University of Akron. Jeanette, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. It's a privilege.
When we look at unemployment in this country, are we seeing different paths lately for men and for women?
We are, especially for workers who don't have a college degree. If we're looking at jobs for workers who might have some training after high school or an associate's degree, we're really seeing divergent pathways for men and for women. There's a lot of growth in jobs that are dominated by women, particularly in the healthcare sector, jobs like nursing assistants or personal care aides, home health aides, those kinds of jobs. And we're seeing a decline in the availability of jobs in the manufacturing sector, in production jobs, which have traditionally been filled by men.
And I don't want to paint a cliche here, but in the election campaign and beyond, we've seen the idea of this high school education, maybe a little more. I had a good paying factory job. That's less of a reality. The factory is gone. And the options left for them pay substantially less. What happens to those men now?
That is a really difficult question. Because the kinds of jobs we're seeing a lot of growth in are generally jobs that men are not interested in taking. So we talked about how we have a lot of growth in these sort of low-level healthcare jobs. These jobs don't pay well, so men would be taking a big pay cut to take a lot of these jobs. And they also are stigmatized as women's work. Men don't see themselves as doing that kind of work.
Right. So going from a welder to being a home health care worker, apart from the pay cut, which would be real, there's this idea of what the kind of work a man does, I guess.
Exactly. A lot of these jobs are very hands-on care kind of jobs, you know, bathing, dressing, feeding, that kind of work. And we associate that kind of work with femaleness, and men are very reluctant to do it. In fact, we've seen very little movement of men into these jobs, even though there's been a lot of growth and high demand for these workers.
Now, looking at what we used to picture as men's work or women's work, we've seen women make a lot of inroads, maybe not to the point of equality, into professions like medicine, the law. There's still high tech, maybe, is another story, at least according to a lot of reports out. Have we seen, first, is that true? And then second, have we seen any movement in the other direction, men coming into the traditionally women's jobs?
Very little. So we've seen a lot of occupations become feminized, meaning they went from being primarily male-dominated to now having many of the workers be women, if not the majority. So we could think of pediatricians. Used to be male-dominated, now most pediatricians are women. But there are a few examples of occupations becoming masculinized or being majority female and then becoming dominated by men. However, we have seen some growth in certain occupations in the healthcare sector where men have started to go into these occupations. So, an example would be nurse anesthetists. It's the highest paying nurse specialty, and about 40% of nurse anesthetists are men. That didn't used to be the case. So men have clearly decided this is a good occupation. The work is not that stigmatized, and so they are going into that occupation.
when we look at the jobs that are, again, I'm talking broad strokes here, but jobs that are pictured as traditionally male and traditionally female, is it the norm that the traditionally female jobs get paid less?
Yes, definitely. Women's work, jobs that are done by mostly women pay less than jobs that are dominated by men. A quick example would be to compare a nursing assistant to a construction worker. A nursing assistant would make about $10 an hour, maybe 12 if they're lucky, while a construction worker could easily make $18 or $20 an hour, perhaps even more. Both jobs require very little training after high school. Both are very physically demanding jobs, but the pay is dramatically different.
Now, what's up with that? Is that a sexism thing? Men's work is viewed as more important and therefore paid better? Or is this something about the men's jobs came about in a time of unionization, so there was an upward wage pressure where maybe for women that didn't happen? What's the story behind that?
Well, I think both of those things are probably true. We undervalue women's work. We assume that that women don't need as much money as men. They're not compensated. Their skills aren't recognized at the same level of compensation. But I think you're right to point out that a lot of men's a lot of the higher wages in men's occupations were gained through union organization and labor movements that we just haven't seen in the service sector. We haven't seen it in healthcare, and we haven't seen it in retail or food service either. So earlier you asked about what is the laid-off factory worker to do. Part of what we may need is another labor movement in the service sector.
Talking to sociologist Jeanette Dill from the University of Akron, talking about trends in gender and work, men's work, women's work, how those views of those things may be changing, and what happens to especially those men with a high school level of education, where those higher paying, say, factory jobs aren't there in as great as numbers, largely because of automation. Jeanette, I read about an interesting phenomenon when men start to enter into the traditionally women workplaces. They get often paid more, promoted faster. I saw the phrase glass escalator, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yes. So the glass escalator is a term that's used to describe this phenomenon that when men go into female-dominated fields, like nursing or teaching, jobs that where the majority of workers are women, they tend to do really well. They are more likely to be promoted. They usually earn wages that are higher than their female counterparts. And so instead of being limited in those jobs, they actually experience a boost or a ride up, which is why it's called the glass escalator.
Looking at the future of work a little bit, the men's jobs, the factory jobs and things like that, is there a sense that, hey, maybe they're going to come back, this problem will sort itself out? Or do we need to start changing our attitudes toward what is men's labor and women's labor?
Well, I think it's pretty unlikely that those manufacturing jobs are going to come back. Maybe I'll be proven wrong. But I do think we will see some shifts around what is men's considered to be men's labor and what's considered to be women's labor. Research that I've done has found that there are some segments of the healthcare sector where we're starting to see quite a few more men. So jobs that have a technical dimension, jobs that are less hands-on but often use some kind of technology, are attractive to men. And we're seeing a big boost in the number of men that are going into these jobs, jobs like radiology technicians or surge techs or ultrasound techs or EMTs, respiratory therapists. These kinds of jobs that are not quite as stigmatized are attractive to men, and So I think we might start seeing a shift there.
But are we going to end up in a place where instead of maybe the men having a little higher paid job, the women having a little lower paid job, we're going to end up with everybody in service and healthcare jobs that are lower paying? I mean, everybody who doesn't have that more advanced training?
Yeah. Well, a lot of economists and sociologists are arguing that we've entered sort of a new era of polarization where we have a lot of good jobs and a lot of bad jobs and not a lot in between. I would like to hope, as I said earlier, that we'll start to see some more labor organization in the service sector that will start to make some changes in the wages that people receive.
And just briefly, as we wrap up, what are the jobs that we're seeing the big growth in? And again, these are mostly ones traditionally associated with women.
A lot of healthcare occupations have high growth. Nursing has had strong growth for a very long time, but also jobs that support other occupations like physical therapy assistants or occupational therapy assistants, and then also jobs that provide a lot of the hands-on care for activities of daily living. Things like home health aides are always in high demand, nursing assistants. Because we have an aging population, people are living longer with more chronic illnesses, there's a high demand for that kind of care.
We'll leave it there for now. Jeanette, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
We've been talking to Jeanette Dill. She's a sociologist at the University of Akron, talking about the challenges facing men in the current economy and attitudes by gender toward different kinds of jobs in the modern day economy.
Coming up after the news, we'll take a look at President Trump's meeting with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Farah. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Listening to Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Coming up after 7 on the Moth Radio Hour, an author describes witnessing the fall of the Berlin Wall as a teenager, and an artist loses 3 years of work in an instant and finds it hard to continue. Those stories and more on the Moth tonight after 7.
First, President Trump met with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu in Washington, D.C. yesterday. In a joint news conference, Trump took a major step away from a decades-long diplomatic stance when he declared that he could support a one-state solution.
Trump also made a point to tell Netanyahu to hold off on building settlements in the contested area of the West Bank, but he also reaffirmed his support of Israel, especially when it comes to countries such as Iran.
Stephen David joins us now to talk about the meeting and what it could mean for U.S. foreign policy in the Middle East moving forward. He's a professor of international relations at Johns Hopkins University. Stephen, welcome back to the show.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
Let's start off with a listen to President Trump talking in that conference yesterday, potentially stepping away from the two-state solution.
So I'm looking at two-state and one-state, and I like the one that both parties like. I'm very happy with the one that both parties like. I can live with either one. I thought for a while the two-state looked like it may be the easier of the two. But honestly, if Bibi and if the Palestinians, if Israel and the Palestinians are happy, I'm happy with the one they like the best.
Stephen, let's start off with the concept of the two-state solution here in Israel and Palestine. What would that mean in practice?
What it would mean in practice would be the establishment of an independent state of Palestine, presumably encompassing most of the West Bank and Gaza, perhaps with parts of Jerusalem as its capital. We should remember that the UN resolution that created Israel in 1947 at the same time created a Palestinian state, and that state never came into being. It was swallowed up in part by Egypt and in part by Jordan. But now it is felt that if you're going to have stable peace in the area, the Palestinians need their own country.
And this has been a linchpin of American foreign policy, the UN, other countries. But how important is that, do you think, that whatever the solution is there, it has to involve two states? Is that really key?
Well, I believe it is key. I mean, if you believe that Israel should be both Jewish and democratic, there is no other solution than to have a Palestinian state. If Israel annexes the West Bank and gives the Arab inhabitants, about 2.7 million, the right to vote, then they're going to vote in an Arab government and it ceases to be a Jewish state. If they don't give them the right to vote, then it ceases to be a democracy. So the only solution, by my thinking, and I think the thinking of many, is that there needs to be two countries living side by side.
So President Trump saying, in effect, one state, two state, whatever it takes, how much do you make of that?
Well, it's not clear to me exactly what he means. My sense is it's not clear to him exactly what he means. I don't understand how a one-state solution can emerge that can provide for peace and stability in the area and also, again, ensure the continuation of Israel as a Jewish and democratic country. Someone would have to explain that to me.
And then we've heard from Nikki Haley, the new ambassador to the United Nations, also the nominee for ambassador to Israel, kind of dialing back the language that President Trump had offered. Do you think this might be just a one-off and we'll return to our regularly scheduled Israel policy?
I mean, again, I mean, who knows? I mean, President Trump, during his campaign, said he was going to move the U.S. Embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem and that you can trust him to follow up on his promises, and now not so much. He was very supportive of the settlements, and in his discussions with Netanyahu, he seemed to push back a little on that. It's not clear to me that President Trump has a clearly formed view of what he wants to see happen in the Middle East, which may explain some of these comments. And which ones will represent real American policy? Stay tuned.
Talking to Stephen David from Johns Hopkins University about the U.S. policy toward Israel, Palestine, and the Middle East after President Trump met with the Prime Minister of Israel just yesterday. Stephen, watching this issue over the years from a media perspective, it seems like the urgency of coming up with a lasting peace, a lasting settlement, ebbs and flows, and it doesn't seem like there's been that sense of urgency, at least from, you know, I mean, we've had a lot of other things in our mind in the United States, I guess, but mm-hmm. Do you feel like there is that sense of urgency from main players here?
No, I agree with you. I think the sense of urgency has dissipated somewhat. I mean, within Israel, things are relatively peaceful. I mean, you have the occasional terror attack, but nothing like the intifadas of years ago. The BDS movement has not really gotten traction, certainly not in the United States.
That's the boycott and divestment.
Boycott, divestment, and sanction movement. In the Arab world, there seems to be more to focus on than the Palestinians. Syria and Iraq are not fully functioning states anymore. Saudi Arabia and Egypt and Jordan are cozying up with Israel as they both fear growing Iranian influence. So the Palestinians are not given the focus that they were in the past. And some of that is the responsibility of the Palestinians. Their own leadership is hopelessly divided. You've got a Palestinian leadership in Gaza, Hamas, that is diametrically opposed to the Palestinian leadership in the West Bank. Mahmoud Abbas, the leader in the West Bank, is, I think, in his 13th year of a four-year term. He's in his early 80s with no clear successor in sight. So the Palestinians are a mess. The Israelis have a strong right-wing government, probably their most right-wing government in their history. So movements towards a peace settlement are as remote as I've ever seen.
And looking at, you were talking about some of the Sunni states there, especially Saudi Arabia, working with Israel. It seems like they're seeing a common enemy in the Shia world in Iran and Hezbollah and affiliated parties in Syria. Is that maybe making at least those leading Sunni nations say the Palestinian issue, that's not on our front burner? That's kind of a side embarrassment in a way, since we're seeing Iran as our bigger problem.
I think there is a lot to that. The Saudis, the Egyptians, the Jordanians feel the spread of Iranian influence much more than they do anything from Israel. And even in the past, presidents, in terms of their memoirs and in private meetings with Arab leaders, would say that the Palestinian issue often did not come up, or if it came up, it was not a pressing concern of the Arab leaders. They talked a big game in public, in part to placate their populations, but I don't think the Palestinians were ever on the front burner of the Arab world, and even less so today.
Talking to Stephen David right now. He's a professor of international relations at Johns Hopkins University. Talk about how President Trump is approaching foreign policy in the Middle East just after his meeting with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu.
And we'd like to hear from you. What are your thoughts on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict? What would you like to hear from President Trump on this issue? Do you agree, perhaps, with the comments he made yesterday, potentially calling for a one-state solution? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can leave a comment on the Central Time Facebook page. We're continuing our conversation about the future of U.S. foreign policy in the Middle East, especially with Israel and Palestine under the Trump administration. We're talking to Stephen David. He's a professor of international relations at Johns Hopkins University.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. What are you hoping for or worried about when it comes to President Trump and his team working in the Middle East? Should this be a priority, a settlement in Israel and Palestine? Should that be at the top of the agenda for President Trump and his foreign policy team? Stephen, I want to get to the settlements issue. President Trump called on the Israeli government to hold off, at least, on the building of settlements in contested territory. Here's a listen.
As far as settlements, I'd like to see you hold back on settlements for a little bit. We'll work something out, but I would like to see a deal be made. I think a deal will be made.
So, Stephen, very controversial, even my use of the phrase contested territory there. I'm sure somebody would argue with that. What do you see in the latest on Israeli settlements?
Well, during the campaign, President Trump was very enthusiastic about Israeli settlement building. Now, a bit less so. I mean, those of us who want to see a two-state solution would hope that the Israeli settlements would be confined to the settlement blocks, those major settlements on the Israeli border, which almost everyone believes will become part of Israel as part of any peace agreement. The settlements that are most controversial are those that are deep in the West Bank, in land that would become a Palestinian state. And the fear is that as more and more Israeli settlements spread, the possibility of a Palestinian state becomes foreclosed. And that is something I would hope that the United States would persuade Israel not to undertake.
Also want to touch a little more on the issue of Iran. Here's President Trump talking about Iran and President Obama's Iran deal. He's been very critical of that.
The security challenges faced by Israel are enormous, including the threat of Iran's nuclear ambitions, which I've talked a lot about. One of the worst deals I've ever seen is the Iran deal. My administration has already imposed new sanctions on Iran, and I will do more to prevent Iran from ever developing, I mean ever, a nuclear weapon.
So, Stephen, that U.S. deal with Iran on nuclear weapons either really held back any potential for nuclear weapons in Iran or greatly accelerated the risk of nuclear weapons in Iran, depending on who you talk to. How do you see this deal playing out as far as U.S. relations with Israel in particular?
Well, most Israelis oppose the deal, and they are, I think, reassured by President Trump's resistance to the deal as well. That said, it's not clear that we are tearing up the deal as President Trump had promised. I mean, my own view is that the deal does have significant problems, namely in that it preserves Iran as a nuclear threshold state, and 10 to 15 years, most of the major constraints are eliminated, and Iran would then be free to develop a nuclear weapon. But you do get 10 to 15 years of relative assurance that Iran will not be developing a nuclear weapon. And in the Middle East, that's not nothing. And, you know, while President Trump has called it a horrible deal, the worst deal ever, I've never heard him propose a feasible alternative. So if it's so bad, what would be better? I'm awaiting that pronouncement.
Let's bring on a caller now. Eric is with us in Beloit. Eric, hi.
Hi. I actually have two questions, and I'll take the answers off the air. My first question is what is the purpose of the new settlements in the contested areas? Is it because there's no room to build, there's a huge population growth, or is it primarily as a buffer for security? And the second question is, if you think the Iran situation is resolved, do you think that will allow more focus to be put on this situation between Israel and the Palestinians?
Eric, thanks. So, Stephen, let's start with settlements. Is the purpose relieving population pressure in Israel, or is it grabbing this territory a security buffer, as Eric said?
Well, different settlements have different purposes. I don't think it's alleviating population pressure. Two-thirds of Israel is the Negev Desert, which has large empty spaces. There's plenty of room within Israel for people to live. Part of the purpose of the settlements is religious. Those who believe that God gave this land to the Jewish people feel that they need to have settlements to establish that claim. It's also an effort to preclude the establishment of a Palestinian state, to create so-called facts on the ground so a Palestinian state can come into being. There is some security rationale, although I tend to be skeptical of that. I think if you need to protect yourself, you protect yourself with military bases, not kindergartens. So I think it's basically this effort to settle the land so that others can't settle it. And that, I think, is I regret that.
And then coming to some, and this is a tall order, but Eric says asks if some kind of settlement with Iran, easing tensions there, does that make it easier to focus on a settlement in Israel and Palestine?
Perhaps, but you're dealing with two conflicts, both of which are somewhat intractable. I would think for a settlement for Iran to happen, you would probably need a new leadership in Iran. I mean, the present leadership does not recognize Israel's right to exist and even goes further. It explicitly threatens the destruction of Israel, and that makes a nuclear-armed Iran all the more frightening, reasonably so to Israelis, because here you have a leadership that says we are going to destroy you and is rapidly getting the capability to do that. It's not something easy to ignore.
And Stephen, briefly as we wrap up, I understand you're working on a book using lessons from ancient Israel, applying them to modern-day Israel. Can you give us a little tease of what we can learn from an Israel threatened by the Romans and the Babylonians to today's affairs?
Sure. I mean, what's important to remember, Israel is one of the only countries in the world whose existence is openly called into question. And Israeli states have disappeared, been destroyed in the past by the Assyrians in 722 B.C., by the Babylonians in 586 B.C., and by the Romans in 70 A.D. It happened a long time ago. It can happen again. And some of the conditions that led to that destruction exist today. Rising hegemons, adversaries in the region, but most of all, internal turmoil that weakened the state, that allowed others to take it over. And hopefully we're not seeing a repeat of that.
We'll leave it there, but maybe talk to you about the book when it comes out. Stephen, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you.
That's Stephen David, professor of international relations at Johns Hopkins University. He joined us to talk about how President Trump is approaching foreign policy in the Middle East just after meeting with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu.
Since the election, reported incidents of people being targeted for their race, ethnicity, sexual orientation, and immigrant status have been happening more frequently all across the country. But for some people, being discriminated against is not new and has taken a toll on their mental health. As Avery Brookins reports, discrimination has been found to heighten stress and cause mental health illnesses such as anxiety, despondency, and depression.
5 years ago, Maya Whitson was accused of stealing shoes, even though she just bought them and had the receipt to prove it.
I've experienced a lot of people's expectations of me because of my color being negative.
Whitson is African American.
It's difficult to live in a world that looks at you for only your color, and I feel like I have to work that much harder to prove that I'm not that person, and that really does add more stress.
Whitson was diagnosed with anxiety unrelated to racism 10 years ago, but she says being stereotyped causes her to feel even more anxious, so much so that she goes to therapy once a week now and regularly talks to her pastor, Joseph Baring, about it.
We were supposed to use the mind of Christ, the motive of Christ.
Pastor Baring is leading a Bible study at St. Paul African Methodist Episcopal Church in Madison. He does this every Wednesday. After the Bible study, Baring stayed to chat with some members of the congregation. About once a month, he stays to speak with Whitson to help her cope with what she's going through.
His position is that, you know, you have to love those who persecute you. And that's hard.
In 2015, the American Psychological Association surveyed thousands of people about stress and its impacts. They found that money and work are the top two primary stressors for adults. But white adults are less likely than minorities to say other common stressors like discrimination are significant. Only 14% of whites said discrimination is a significant source of stress, compared to 40% of black adults. And the survey tied discrimination to higher levels of reported stress and poorer reported health.
I've seen people who suffer all the time from discrimination, some form of it, all the time. It's typical.
That's Don Coleman. He's an associate at Midwest Center for Human Services in Madison and has worked in psychotherapy for about 40 years.
If I don't talk the right way, if I don't look the right way, if I don't, you know, if I'm not doing things the way in which the dominant culture believes I should behave, I'm likely to get negative messages about my self-worth and so on.
Coleman says people can internalize those messages.
You begin to have negative thoughts about yourself. Negative thinking about oneself typically will lead to despondency and depression. Also, if I'm out in the world and I'm worried about, concerned about how other people view me, that raises my anxiety level.
The survey said people can stress out even if they're just anticipating discrimination throughout the day. Whitson says that's the case for her.
Before, I used to carry really big, like, duffel bags. And now I take smaller purses because I'm less likely to get looked at. And then there are times where it's not even happening, but I think that it is. You know, I'm looking for somebody to be looking at me, which in turn makes people look at you because now I'm looking guilty, but it's just my anxiety.
Pastor Baring says he tells Whitson she can't control how other people treat her, but there's still a way for her to find more peace in her life.
I told her that you're always going to have problems. You're always going to have issues. You're going to get stereotyped, and you can't control how they're going to. How people are going to respond to you. You can only control how you respond to what they do.
Whitson says she tries to focus more on the joyous things in life because she knows people will never stop judging her for her skin color. Avery Brookins, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, an economist says now is the time to reinvent yourself, change jobs, pursue an encore career, negotiate a flex schedule, or launch a business. We'll learn why 2017 is prime for fresh starts.
Can you hear me okay? That's the opening line of a phone scam going around. The Wisconsin Better Business Bureau will tell us what to watch out for and how to avoid getting scammed.
And on Food Friday, we'll learn the anatomy of a cream puff, Rob. Our guest takes us step by step in making choux pastry that holds together the mouth-watering creamy filling.
We can recreate the State Fair cream puff at home, and we'll have our weekly check-in on the big news stories in Wisconsin, including a candidate not running for the U.S. Senate and how that may shake up the race. That and look at some of the top news stories of the day coming up tomorrow here on Central Time.